welcome to the Novel Ideas Podcast.
The Novel Ideas Podcast, a podcast with two siblings who love books.
Yeah, although neither one of us can read Chinese, so we weren't able to read the book for this week.
Right. That was an issue I had.
We're going to talk about it anyway.
Yeah, I think my mother is vaguely disappointed, which is weird because she also can't read Chinese.
I'm pretty sure the author of this book can't read Chinese. Well, I actually don't know. I don't know if Amy Tan can read Chinese or not.
I don't know how much of the daughters in this story were autobiographical.
Yeah, are her. Yeah.
I almost wonder if we should have found a Chinese American to record this podcast with.
Oh, to see if, like, how accurate everything is, sort of thing.
Yeah. Just to get a slant on things, you know?
Yeah. Wouldn't be a bad idea. Unfortunately, I do have a Chinese American friend. In Lawrence, I'll call her right now.
I'm just gonna call Jeremy Lin. I think he's Taiwanese, which is...
racist.
Which is different. Different but the same. But different at the same time.
Yeah. So we read The Joy Luck Club this week by Amy Tan.
Yes.
It is not, in fact, written in Chinese.
No. If it was, then my reading it would... well, it'd have less illuminating things to say about it. Which might be saying something, because I'm not sure I understood anything I read this week.
I think this week is going to be like, I liked this book, and Ben being like, me too. I actually have been considering starting a reading club on the side of Novel Ideas, and occasionally doing Novel Ideas books, and this would be one that I would like to do for a book club.
This would be a good book club.
If everyone read it.
Right.
Oh, good. So we chose the book mostly because we were deciding what we wanted to read next, you know, 3 weeks ago, and I realized that we'd had a string of white dudes as authors, and it kind of offended my sensibilities right. A little bit. And we're doing a female author next week, so I said, let's do another female author, and popped up my list, and we decided to do a 1-2 punch and do a female author who's not white.
Yeah. If you can imagine such a thing.
So
I say that one.
Our attempt at mild diversity.
Yeah.
And oddly enough, out of, you know, the past 6 books that we've read that have been by white dudes, this is probably my favorite one. I don't know if that says something about the book, or me, or the white dudes, or what. But I'll throw that out there. Okay, so our overview genre was kind of difficult this week, and we will soon get into why this book is difficult on a couple of levels. But it doesn't really fall into a genre as far as we can tell, aside from vague things we were coming up with, like literary fiction, women's fiction, Chinese-American fiction.
Immigrant fiction?
Yeah.
Is that a thing?
Are any of these things?
I think some books don't need to be classified necessarily.
Yeah.
And, I mean, maybe even most books. Like, sometimes putting a book in a genre is probably helpful for selling it, but that's probably the only reason to put it there.
And some books, you know, knowing the genre, like, if you read Ender's Game, for example... it's definitely within the sci-fi world, and having read other science fiction, you can see how he plays with and or breaks tropes that you typically find in sci-fi.
Right.
So genre fiction can be useful for that reason, but in a book like this, there's not really other stuff, as far as I know, that she's playing off of, aside from real-life experiences, so.
Yeah, and I just don't think it's helpful to find a genre for something that's kind of more open on what it would actually be, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I really do think that a lot of the reason that a publisher puts something out in a genre, so to speak, is to market it.
Yeah.
More than because it's really important to figure out which genre something is. So I think this probably since I always raise this question, but I think this falls in the category of literary fiction, which is, I've decided, is just a catch-all for anything that can't be easily classified into a genre.
I would also like to state that if you count women's fiction as a genre, this would definitely fall under the umbrella. But I also really don't like the concept of women's fiction, unless it's just, you know, it means it's a book about women. But I don't like the idea of, this is fiction that only women should read. Because it's about girls, and boys don't want to read about girls.
Right. Ralph wouldn't read this book.
Yeah. He's our barometer for a lot of these things.
Right, that's right. Ralph from Lord of the Flies, for people who listened to, like, our first three episodes.
No, that was
a little later on.
Yeah, it was okay. One of our early ones, but... Yeah, so... Unlike most of the books we've been reading lately, this does focus on women and their relationships with each other. But if you are a dude, that doesn't mean this book isn't for you, so...
I read this book and I enjoyed it, even though it felt a little bit like I'd been smacked upside the head with a saucepan. So...
That's because I actually smacked you upside the head with a saucepan.
Oh, no wonder.
You just don't remember.
Yeah, Gav knows I'm only open-minded to books about women if I'm also concussed. So. This weird thing. My whole personality shifts. Just until I heal up, though.
Yeah, it'll be fine. You're just not going to sleep tonight. So, because of the nature of the book, hard to pin a genre, hard to pin a plot, isn't really a protagonist, we had a hard time coming up with a plot synopsis. And Ben's tired, so we kind of lamely came up with China isn't America.
Which is a fact, I would like to point out.
It is a 100% cold hard fact.
I can prove it.
China is certainly not America.
I can prove it on a map.
And that is kind of one of the themes of the book, is China differences in living in China and America, so
yeah,
we'll go ahead and throw it out there as a related to the topic of conversation. I can't really give a brief summary. I could try, but mostly you just have to know the book centers around four mothers who come from China, who immigrated to the United States in mid-century, 20th century, and then their daughters who were... I think they were all born in America.
I think you're right.
Or at least, okay, I was going to say, tiny little infants when they came over, but I think they were all born in America. And these eight women all have alternating chapters discussing points in their lives and just kind of learn stories about all of them and their relationships with each other. Yeah, so.
And there's not a through thread that links all of these stories together.
Right.
They're bookended, but that's about it.
And you know that they're all related because, you know, occasionally you'll get like a, oh, I was doing this and I ran into so-and-so who's in another chapter or whatever. So, you know, we know that they all know each other and that all the mothers are good friends who play mahjong with each other every week, but...
That's where the title of the book comes from.
Yeah.
It actually is only mentioned in the first chapter, really.
Mm-hmm.
Other than maybe tangentially once or twice, but yeah, just the whole setup. Like, I kind of expected after that first chapter there to be a lot more centered around that night, and...
Me too.
Yeah, I remember you telling me you thought the daughters were maybe going to have their own version of it, and it seems like these daughters are not necessarily friends, and in fact, some straight up don't like each other.
Yeah. Yes. Maybe with the death of her mother, Jingmei will want to gather together all her mother's friends' daughters to make their own Mahjong Joy Luck Club. Oh, no, it's nothing to do with anything. Okay.
It wouldn't really fit the ideas in the book anyway. It'd be more likely she'd form together with some of her white friends and have a bridge night or something.
Yeah. Play poker, something like that.
Or a poker night. Yeah, exactly.
Setting is San Francisco and China, several different locations in China. I guess Ben and I might want to post a disclaimer up front that both of us are fairly ignorant about Chinese culture and history. So we are going to stick to character names. We think we can pronounce all of them. We're not going to try to pronounce the various cities in China, which we probably, unfortunately, cannot remember, just because we're not used to it. So, if you know Chinese or are Chinese or realize we're butchering something, feel free to let us know, and we will apologize for it next time.
Yeah, well, in the meanwhile, know that we're trying our best, and our best is very, very white American.
We're doing what we can. Sorry, guys. I just thought I'd throw that out there before
I think that's a fair point. That's probably more necessary than a spoiler warning for this book. Yeah,
I'd say there aren't really spoilers for the book.
Yeah, I was going to say. By the way, there is a spoiler warning in the sense that we'll talk about anything we happen to think of, but I can't imagine what you could spoil in this book that would make that would reduce the satisfaction in reading it afterwards. Yeah,
or that make you be lose a gasp moment. Yeah. Those don't really exist, so... okay, so as we mentioned, because it's told from the points of view of 8 different women, there is not really a protagonist, as far as we can tell.
I wouldn't even care to make an argument in favor of one of them being the protagonist.
Yeah, I would say they all get roughly equal page time, and trying to determine one is a futile effort, so... I think we're just gonna go ahead and say there's a record 8 co-tagonists. Octagonists.
Well, one of them is dead, so maybe 7.
Septagonists. And go from there.
I like it.
Go-tagonists. Do you want to do mothers, daughters? Do you want to do a mother and then a daughter? How do you want to approach this?
Why don't we try to link mothers and daughters together?
Okay. We'll go ahead and start then with Suyeon Woo, who was the creator of the Joy Luck Club.
Yes.
And the book more or less starts with her story. We know that she's recently passed away, and we get the story that she tells her daughter about when she was living in China with her first husband and 2 daughters. And essentially, she was living in a town that got invaded by the Japanese during World War II, and ran away from the town with her daughters, and eventually got to where she was headed, but her daughters weren't with her. And she never really illuminated on that point for her own daughter, who's now in America.
Right.
But this Joy Luck Club was just basically a mahjong night with other commanders' wives. And apparently all of the women from China in the book are really obsessed with luck and creating luck and bad prophecies and avoiding that sort of thing. And, so that holds a lot of significance for them, but...
It seems to be a cultural thread.
Yeah.
Because the story is the mother's stories, they're, I guess, almost... I almost want to say origin stories, like they're superheroes or something.
Back they're all badasses.
That's right. Well, they kind of are in their own way.
Old Asian ladies, yeah.
Back in China, there is definitely a lot of... ideas related to luck or charms and I guess superstitions and
kind of omens, just things can be a sign of good luck and bad luck, and people take it seriously.
It's presented very matter-of-factly, which I thought was interesting.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like it's less of a, oh man, you have to do this because this is, you know, what this says and this is the right way to do things. It's not so much mystical like you might expect from at least the Americanized versions of Eastern religions. Yeah.
Of Asia.
It's more like, yeah, we're gonna go to this we're gonna do this ceremony because that's what you do, and we're gonna do this thing at the ceremony because that's how we're gonna get favor on us from our ancestors.
It kind of reminded me of Roman religion, honestly. Like, you go do the ceremony in this exact way so the gods won't be mad at you.
Right, yeah.
And that's like what ancient Romans did. Go through your ceremony precisely, and then you'll be fine. Yeah, or, you know, if you bring up, oh, I had this dream that an ancestor came to me and said this was going to happen, people aren't going to be like, whatever, it was just a dream. Like, they'll actually listen to you.
Right.
Whereas if someone in America was like, I had a dream that grandma came and talked to me and told me that we were doomed, people would be like, okay, that's nice.
Right.
Like, they would not take you seriously.
It wouldn't be a major cause for concern.
Yeah.
Let's put it that way.
So yeah, a different viewpoint there. Okay. Suyeon is also kind of she reminded me kind of the traditional portrait of an Asian mom when, she was trying to find out what her daughter was going to be a prodigy in.
Right.
Just come home and be like, read this page for 5 minutes and then see if you remember all of it.
Or, now well, you're not so good at that.
Yeah. Now you're going to sing. Now you're going to, I don't even remember everything you're not she good had at that do. Either, yeah. Yeah. Finally. Okay, you're going to be a piano player. And it turns out, well, she maybe could have been good at that, but there are drawbacks to having a deaf piano teacher. In that he won't ever correct wrong notes.
He seemed like a nice old guy.
He did! Oh, brilliant! Wonderful!
But maybe not a very effective piano teacher.
Hey, she had good posture and form. She just didn't correct any wrong notes.
And she was kind of determined not to be good at it anyway.
Yeah. Yeah, and so here's where we have the first culture clash. So you kind of had the typical Asian mom thing, or what we think as a typical Asian mom thing, of like, you must be awesome at this thing at a young age, so you're gonna be the greatest piano player. And then the daughter, Jingmei in this case, rebelling against her mom, saying, I don't want to be good at the piano if you're gonna make me be good at the piano. But Chinese daughters are supposed to be obedient and do what their mothers tell them.
Right.
And not be stubborn little brats. And so, I mean, I could totally see from the daughter's point of view, I would not want to do that shit.
Right, especially being all Americanized and, you know, I want to be my own person. It was one of the other girls who kept saying that, right? That was,
Yeah. Waverly?
That's what I wanted to say, but I had no confidence in myself.
Yeah. So Jingmei has this disastrous piano recital experience where she plays the song like absolute crap because she didn't practice enough on it. And her mom still expects her to continue piano lessons, but she manages to get out of it. I think by yelling some pretty horrible shit at her mom, but...
Yeah.
So you have all that set up between the mother and daughter. The daughter's supposed to be obedient, but she's stubborn. The mom kind of doing the typical Asian mom thing. But when you think about it, on one hand, Suyeon's kind of competing with her really good friend whose own daughter does happen to be a prodigy at something. So she's kind of grasping at straws, trying to, you know, hold on to her pride there.
Right.
Because when you have the whose kid is better pissing contest, yeah. Like, you want to make sure your kid's good at something.
That's true. I don't think those contests usually end very well for the children.
Yeah.
Except maybe the one who actually is better than everyone else.
Well.
In the rare occasion where that actually happens.
Maybe. I feel like I would be pretty embarrassed, though.
I certainly wouldn't want to have my mom telling everybody about that if I was in that situation. This is Ben. He's so brilliant. He can do all of this stuff because he's just better than other kids. I'd be like, really? Do that in front of, like, other people have kids, Mom.
Well, I get embarrassed when our parents were just like, oh, Gabs, we got her report card back. She has straight A's. And I'd be like, oh, God, please don't tell people that. What are you doing?
That's why it helps to have siblings, because siblings will bring you right back down
to earth. Yeah, exactly.
If you start to get a big head about something like that.
You think you're too cool. Your kids, your brothers and sisters will meet you, call you an idiot and punch you until you cry.
I had straight A's, so you want me to beat you up? Is that what you're saying?
Okay.
It's not what I was saying, but I guess that's what's going to happen. Or, so what? So did I. Or...
Yeah, a lot of things. Oh, good shit.
Exactly.
And I was going to say, Jing Mei, so one of the daughter characters who I've been referencing, she kind of has a history of disappointing her mom. So after the whole piano thing, you find out that she changed her major a couple of times in college and then never graduated and dropped out and got a job that wasn't illustrious as she probably should have and isn't married and, you know, isn't having kids or any of this stuff. So, she feels like her whole life she's probably just not done what her mom has wanted her to do.
Yeah. Sounds a little bit to me like she's also never quite committed all the way to anything.
Yeah.
And that's a little bit of it, too.
Like, purposefully disappointing her mom? Just
in some ways, yes.
To be stubborn?
Like that piano recital story being kind of a miniature version of everything else, mm-hmm. I guess. A microcosm, if you will.
Yeah. It is interesting because all of the stories kind of draw back into the relationships. So, you know, if you talk about Jing Mei's quote-unquote failures, like, maybe it is a reflection of her mom and, like, on some level, not doing well just because she doesn't want to give her mom that satisfaction. And maybe her mom is pushing her so hard because she's thinking about the two daughters she had to leave behind and, you know, is kind of trying to get the experience of all three in one, or, like, whatever the case is, so.
Yeah, or maybe just the, maybe those Chinese and American ideals are not fully compatible as one of the other, as one of the other characters.
Yeah.
Saying, talking about their Chinese face and American face.
Yes. Okay. I also ahead to talk about Lindo Zhang. So we were talking earlier about if you have a dream about an ancestor telling you something's gonna go awry, Lindo totally monopolizes or, you know, catches on to this and uses it to her own advantage. Because she is the victim of one of those matchmaking schemes when she was like a 2-year-old or something.
Right.
And her family basically has to send her off to go live with the family when she's like 13 or 14. Because they ran into some financial problems because of a flood. And her mother-in-law, I guess, is kind of doing the evil stepmother thing where she has to, like, cook and clean all day. And then her husband's, of course, is an underdeveloped brat.
Yeah.
That's how that works. And, so the two of them get married and they're expecting grandsons. But the son won't actually, like, have sex with her.
Right, which is fine in her book.
Yeah, she's okay with this. She kind of tries a little bit because she doesn't like getting blamed for all of it. Because he's like, oh, she's too cold. She won't love me all this.
Well, yeah, of course he turns on her immediately.
Mm-hmm.
She makes one semi-honest attempt.
Yeah.
Realizes that, oh, this isn't going to happen.
Yeah.
Because he's not
interested.
Doesn't seem to be interested in
sex
or women. Or women, or
both.
Yes.
But I mean, it's escalated to the point where she is forced to lie in bed all day and think about babies by her mother-in-law. And she's like, okay, well, this is never gonna amount to anything. So she concocts this tale about having a dream of one of her husband's family's ancestors came down and said that their matchmaking candle blew out when it wasn't supposed to and their marriage is doomed, and then she comes up with these pieces of evidence and proof that the marriage is doomed of, you know, basically just things she noticed off of good observation. And one of those things is she happens to realize one of the servant girls in the house is pregnant by some random dude, basically.
Yeah.
And convinces the family that this servant girl actually has royal ancestry and is worthy of marrying their son, and she'll have kids for them. And because her marriage is doomed anyway, they basically pay her off and send her off, and then the pregnant servant gets to marry this guy before anyone notices she's pregnant, and then she gives them the grandson they always wanted.
And everybody wins.
I love that story. I just thought it was great because she's just playing off of all these, you know, Chinese superstitions about ancestors and omens and all this stuff, and totally gets it to her own advantage in a situation where women are essentially just, you know, the properties of their husband and only good for bearing children. So, but that was a pretty awesome way for her to get out of that situation.
The story does raise one question in my mind, which is, could you think of a person you would less want to know than someone who enjoyed lying in bed all day thinking about babies?
God. I would not be able to do that. That would drive me freaking crazy.
I'm not sure if I lie in bed for 7 minutes and think about babies.
There's no way she was actually thinking about babies.
Well, that's probably true.
It really gives you new perspective to the women who have to be on bed rest for like 3 months straight while they're pregnant.
Yeah.
I mean, they're probably not thinking about babies the entire time.
Well, but to be fair.
Just the idea of lying in bed all day sounds, like, when you don't want to. Sounds awful.
You're thinking about, I'd like to get out of this bed, stupid baby.
Dumb baby, idiot.
But I guess if you're willing to go through the bed rest, you're kind of tacitly admitting that you're on the baby's side. Otherwise you'd be like, I don't give a shit.
I'm gonna get up.
Gonna walk around. Bye-bye, baby.
Suck it. Oh my god. I'm just imagining if like you admitted to doing that, like you would be so demonized by everyone.
Oh yeah.
You're like, oh, the doctor put me on bed rest, but I don't want to be on bed rest, so I just like kept working out and walking around and I had a miscarriage, whatever. And everyone would be like, oh my god, you're a monster.
This baby-hating tangent brought to you by...
Well, that was kind of random, but... And so, Lindo, after all that...
Right.
...managed to make her way to America. She was the one who worked in the fortune cookie factory and got married by giving her prospective spouse a piece of
that's right.
Or a fortune.
Some sage advice from a fortune cookie.
Yeah. Home is not home when your spouse is not there, or something like that.
Yeah.
And then the next day he said, will you spouse me? Which is pretty adorable.
Yeah, that was pretty cute.
So her daughter is Waverly, who is the prodigy we mentioned. She is a chess prodigy as a young girl.
She is, until she loses her confidence.
Because her mom stops building her up.
That's right.
So again, we have the mother-daughter interconnectedness thing. And again, you have her mom kind of doing the typical, what you might think is a typical Asian mom thing, like constantly hovering over her while she's studying the chessboard, giving her all this advice before tournaments, running around town and bragging about her constantly, polishing her trophies every day, and just, you know, generally driving her completely insane. You know, oh, we're gonna go shopping with me, and then every single store you walk into, this is my daughter Waverly, she's a chess champion.
It's like, no, stop doing that.
But, I mean, it sounds like she was legitimately really freaking good at chess. She had an article about her in Time. And
right.
And was, like, close to being designated as a master and, like, all this stuff. And then one afternoon, she and her mom get into a big fight. And I think that's when Waverly says, like, she wants to be her own person.
Yeah.
Like, stop hovering over me. And so mom just doesn't take interest in chess anymore. Doesn't hover over her, doesn't ask her how's it going, doesn't demand she does tournaments or play or anything. Which, you know, as the young girl, she was expecting, oh, if I refuse to play in this tournament, then my mom's going to start badgering me to play again. And so when she does finally return to the game of her own choice, she's kind of lost her mojo. Mom stops taking interest, and she just can't seem to regain her former glory.
Yeah, that... I mean, I guess I've heard or read versions of that story before where someone's great at something and kind of loses their confidence. And actually, I guess a lot of sports stories, movies are about someone losing that and then trying to get it back.
Mm-hmm.
And usually succeeding by the end. You know, whatever off-the-field thing they have going on. I guess this is... This would fall into that same genre, even though chess is not all that strenuous of a sport, perhaps.
Only for your brain.
Have no idea where I'm going with this thought.
Anymore. Okay.
I hate that shit.
I was going to mention that I heard a story on the radio of some baseball pitcher who is apparently really good. And then, totally lost his shit during, the World Series or something.
Yeah,
I know. And, that. Never started pitching well again and had to drop out of the league.
Yeah. I can't come up with his name off the top of my head, but I know exactly.
It was really interesting.
I know exactly who you're talking about.
That's exactly what I thought of when you mentioned sports players lose their mojo. I was like, that pitcher guy! And he never got it back. And Waverly never got hers back either. And she definitely struggles with, you know, her mother's approval, her mother being overbearing, her mother being too critical, whatever's going on, you know. She just doesn't like anything. Well, anyone does, really, it seems like. But especially doesn't seem to approve of Waverly's choice of her second husband, won't talk about him, unless it's to say something that seems like an insult. At the moment, the two of them finally connected toward the end, where she said, Mom, why are you always bagging on Rich and all this other stuff about my life? And her mom's like, what are you talking about?
She had no idea what she meant.
Yeah. You think that's an insult to you? I'm just pointing something out. Or that doesn't bother me. Or, you know.
Right.
What's going on here? And so they kind of finally have a conversation where her mom tells her a little bit about her past and... Then Waverly kind of comes to the realization that they haven't been communicating that well.
Yeah.
That her mom was waiting for her to invite her back into her life, and she's waiting for her mom to invite her back into her life. And, again, I mean, touching on themes of mothers and daughters' stories being intertwined, and also not always just miscommunication, but sometimes just being unable to get your ideas across, because the four mother characters are so rooted in China since they grew up there, and the daughters are so American that sometimes these Chinese and American ideas just don't.
Yeah, it'll save that generational divide as well as that cultural divide at the same time.
Because if you're an American kid, and your mom is telling you that, you know, oh, you didn't eat all the rice in your bowl, so now your husband's gonna have pockmarks in his face. You're right. Shut up.
Right.
Yeah, so Yingying was the only one of the original or the older generation. She actually married a white dude.
Right.
He's Irish, European dude.
He likes bacon and eggs.
Yeah. Apparently, you really like bacon and eggs. So, Lena, their daughter, is actually, I guess, only half Chinese. But she apparently looks fairly Chinese and still dealing with those issues. So, but Yingying, so she also grew up in China. Her family was really wealthy when she was growing up. So she was used to, you know, all the beauty and the jewels and the comfort and et cetera, et cetera. And she ended up marrying a family friend or a cousin or someone related to the family somehow who ended up being a twat.
Yeah, yes.
He ran out after, like, I don't know, less than a year, it seemed like.
Well, yeah, she met him when she was 16. He was gone by the time she was 18.
Yeah, so, they get married, he manages to get her pregnant, he runs off and starts taking up with all these other women and never comes back, essentially. Yeah.
Until he dies of it.
Which is awesome.
Poetic justice.
Plus, the other thing is that all these women from China keep talking about how you can't divorce your husband, you're only, like, a widow, or you're only truly free of him when he dies, and even then you're not supposed to remarry, because once you marry, like, he's your husband for life. Which made me go, what?
You're like, I don't think so.
That's insane. It's just making me think of these girls who get married. If your husband dies in a freak accident a year later, you're supposed to be a widow for the rest of your life.
That's yeah.
Freaking nuts.
Come on, Gabs.
Kind of reminded me of Antebellum South in Gone with the Wind. Scarlett's husband dies, and she's in mourning for, I don't know, however long, and she gets out of mourning before, you know, like, the 5-year period is up, right. And everyone's scandalized, and it's silly. But anyway, so Ying Ying, yeah, her husband abandons her, she's pregnant, but manages to, like, will the baby away. She does. She's kind of vague about it. She's like, I didn't want him, so I ripped him out. You're like, what? Okay. So apparently she had an abortion, but
maybe a self-administered one.
Yeah, it's not 100% clear there. And then went out and made something of herself. Stayed with some family, then went and worked in a shop and met this white guy. She finally agreed to marry after her first husband died.
Right.
She was still trapped up in that tradition, even if she was never going to see the guy again. Never wanted to speak his name or mention his existence.
For that matter, she could have left the country, married the man, and no one ever would have been the wiser.
Yeah. And one of the interesting things I thought about Ying Ying is that she's the one who sees all these kind of, like, dark prophecies. She's the mom who's like, oh, if you go out and do that, like, you'll get hit by a car and die.
Right.
Or, the really crazy one was when her daughter's young, she's talking to her mom's going around trying to rearrange this new apartment they moved into and saying, it's too slanted, I can't get it to balance out, everything's slanted. And turns out she's pregnant, and her kid is born with no brain. The description was the doctor said you just see right back to the through the skull, so apparently the kid had no brain and died right after being born.
Not surprisingly.
Which the mother blames on the apartment.
Right.
And that's how she knew the baby was going to be messed up, was the apartment. And she has other sorts of kind of premonitions like that. And they're usually focused around some kind of misfortune or bad luck. I just wanted to mention, so you have, up until this point, you know, we talked about Suyeon, who wants her daughter to be a prodigy at something, but she rebels. And then you have Lindo, who is, like, constantly criticizing everything her daughter does. And then we have Ying Ying, who's making all these, like, superstitious Chinese prophecy-type things. So, you know, you have three moms who kind of have three different aspects of the stereotypical Asian personality going on here. And a lot of the times, all of those sides of their personalities seem to come out full force when their daughters are talking about them, but are much different when they're talking about themselves or managing to break through with
the way they see the world.
Mm-hmm. So then Lena, who is Ying Ying's daughter, she had this kind of fun backstory where, her mother told her if she left grains of rice in her bowl, then her future husband would get that many pockmarks on his face. And so, I mean, I think it's just a way to kind of get you to eat all your food.
Right. Of course, yeah.
Yeah. So, her mind immediately jumps to this kid in the neighborhood who, for some reason she's like, oh god, what if I'm gonna marry him? I don't like him. I'm gonna sabotage him. And so then she just like stops eating all of her food, or only eats part of it.
Right.
To try and screw this guy over. And then happens to find out randomly down the line that he dies at the age of 18, really randomly. And she's terrified that she somehow was the one who killed him murder, out of spite. Like,
murder by anorexia.
Yeah, yeah. which she thinks, like, her mother would probably buy into, because that's the sort of thing that...
Probably wouldn't hold up in a court of law, though.
No. I'm pretty sure someone's like, they didn't finish their rice, so it killed my son.
The prosecution will prove that the accused did murder the victim by not finishing her rice every night. Case dismissed, gavel.
Get out. So that was, and Lena refusing to finish her food was also her rebellion against her mother, like, I'll show you, I won't finish eating my food, Mom. And she grows up to kind of be in this crazy marriage of splitting everything in half.
Of, like, unequal equality.
Yeah. Which I know Ben was interested in.
It was just a really crazy system, like, they split everything down the middle, and then if they bought anything that wasn't going to, like, be repaid, it was always a considered a gift or something. But they actually kept a freaking list on the refrigerator, tallied down to the damn penny.
Yeah, they had, like, Lena's list and whatever that guy's name is list, and it's like, groceries, dinner,
right,
whatever else, stuff for the garage. And so, you know, if you get toward the end of the month and it's like, oh, he spent $100 more, then she'll have to, like, buy the rest of the stuff until...
She'd write him a check is what it sounded like.
Oh, yeah, no, she did mention that, yeah. I mean, it's crazy. But then she also mentions that he's making, like, 7 times as much money as her.
Right, at the same firm that he is owns. The boss of.
Yeah, but he won't promote her because he doesn't want to show favoritism.
That was kind of shitty.
Yeah. She's like, well, you know, we both get to plan the joint vacation we take, and we go on a couple other vacations that he pays for entirely, but then he gets to make all the decisions about him because it's his money, sort of thing.
Right.
It's like, what is going on?
Like, how does this work for you? I guess it doesn't, eventually.
Yeah. Lena kind of realizes that it's a fucked up system.
Yeah.
And so does her mother, for that matter.
Yes.
She's the one who kind of triggers her into finally saying something about it.
Hey, you should probably talk to your husband. Or your soon-to-be ex-husband, I guess, is really more the context of it.
They didn't get divorced in the book, so it's possible they worked things out.
I had him mixed up with a different couple.
Yeah. Lena doesn't get divorced, but might be getting divorced. And Rose does get divorced. Right. So many divorces. I don't think there's, like, a single marriage in this book that is happy and works.
I mean, the mothers...
They all have at least pretty bad first experiences with husbands.
Yeah, so their husbands don't seem to have anything particularly wrong with them, at least outside of the ones in China.
Yeah.
They have a couple of them get a little more deeply in the circumstances about it, and it's a little... It's not maybe like the Hollywood love story, necessarily. Like, there's a big pragmatic streak to it.
Yeah, well, that was actually a point of interest or a theme or something that I forgot to put on the list, was that the Chinese mothers, they'll seem to like their current husbands, but none of them seem to be madly in love with their current husbands. You know, just kind of see it for what it is. But they all stay married.
Right.
And they're gonna stay married. And then all the daughters who are, like, trying to do the American thing and marrying for love are all getting divorced.
Right.
Or not finding husbands or running into problems.
There's probably something, at least, to the idea of if you're married for practical reasons, you'll find practical reasons to maintain it.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to doing it on feelings. Purely on feelings.
Oh, feelings.
Oh, feelings.
You're so stupid.
Frequently. Usually.
But I liked the assessment of the one daughter, Rose, who we haven't talked about yet, who she married her doctor boyfriend from college, or pre-med boyfriend from college. And essentially it seemed like his mom gave her the, well, he's going to be really busy with school and stuff and won't be able to have time for a girlfriend. He won't be able to get married for a really long time. And then when she brought that up to her boyfriend, he was like, screw my mom, she doesn't know what she's talking about. And then they basically, like, stayed together, like, as a fuck you to other people.
Out of rebellion.
And then it wasn't until they'd been married for however long that they went, oh shit, like, we probably should not have done this.
I'd say it's a very young people type of reason to be together.
And it actually kind of sounds like Waverly's first marriage. She married her high school sweetheart, and they eloped without telling her
right,
mom,
because
they didn't want to face her disapproval. Kind of the same thing. Like, it'll be so romantic, we can get eloped, and we don't have to worry about our families.
That's right.
And then 5-10 years later, you're like, oh, shit.
What did I do?
This was a horrible idea. Yeah, you have to get to know each other's families really well, so they'll all shame you in staying together.
That's right.
That's exactly what I'm doing. Okay. Yeah, and then Rose's mother is Anne May, and her backstory from China doesn't actually have to do with her having a bad husband, but it's more of a story of her relationship with her own mother. So again, we have another mom thrown into the mix here. And Anne May was at first raised by her grandmother, who said, your mom doesn't, she's a ghost, she doesn't fucking matter. And then her mom shows up again, and everyone's like, you're horrible, get out of here,
right.
Blah, blah, blah. But Anne May goes with her mom, because they connect. And she finds out her mother is the fourth wife to this rich guy, because I guess at that point in China, you could take on multiple wives.
They were referred to as wives, but other than the first wife, they were also referred to as concubines.
Yeah.
So I don't know if that was, I don't know if there's an important legal distinction there.
Yeah. Basically, everyone is viewing her as a prostitute because her first husband died and she married, you know, became a concubine to this other guy.
Right.
So now she's a horrible person. And we later find out that she was tricked into it and did not want to do it, but
yeah, tricked into it, more even coerced into it.
Well, yeah, that's actually a better way to phrase it.
Yeah.
And sexually assaulted and lots of horrible stuff in the meantime, actually.
Part of the coercion, yes.
And so the way her mother gets her revenge is that the only way you can escape marriage in China is if you die. But husbands are terrified. This particular husband is at least terrified of his wife's killing themselves and then coming back to haunt him. And so her mom committed suicide, I think they said, two days before the Chinese New Year. And then 3 days after was the traditional time where their spirit comes back to fall around the people you knew on Earth. And the Chinese New Year is the day where you have to keep all the promises that you make. And so her husband is terrified that she's going to haunt him, and so he promises to raise her daughter as his own child. And one of the wives, who was a horrible person, also was making all these promises and stuff. And she basically, you know, made it so that Anne May was going to grow up having a good life.
Right.
By killing herself. And so it was kind of her getting the upper hand cleverly, even though she did it by killing herself. It was kind of a weird distinction there.
Mm.
But she's, you know, playing on Chinese superstitions and all that sort of stuff, too.
Right.
So, a lot of that is steeped in the Chinese culture. All right. I think we talked about everybody.
Yes.
And all their backstories.
I think so.
Okay. So, moral issues. Of course, I'm going to bring up feminism like I always do. But in the case of this book, we just wanted to point out all of the characters of significance are women. The entire book is centered around women's relationships with each other. The men are there, and occasionally feature in the story, like, you know, I'm getting a divorce. Well, it's kind of a big deal, but it's more like how she's dealing, how Rose is dealing with herself and figuring herself out, her relationship with her mom as she's going through the divorce, as opposed to the guy.
Right.
And so it's kind of the opposite a lot of the books we read, where I'm like, there's, like, one girl and she doesn't do anything. In this case, it's like, they're all women and their relationships and they're all 3D characters. And instead it's like, I guess they're not really any dudes. There are some. They talk. They have a personality, but they're not that important. It's kind of crazy.
I feel oppressed, Gabs.
Yeah, out of, you know, 70 books we've read for novel ideas.
One
of yeah. them. And the other, like, 50 of the other ones are...
Yeah, right?
9 good enough representation of women, and then, like, 19 are pretty good.
Well, you know, finally reading the book that does have the opposite ratio puts it into pretty stark contrast of how uncommon it is to represent women well, especially... Or to the point where you could argue they're overrepresented.
Yeah.
And that when you do, it becomes a women's book.
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, just like, I mean, I could talk about that kind of shit all day.
I know you can.
There's a discussion in YA literature, especially, of how young girls and boys read YA featuring male heroes. But the second a YA book has a female heroine, only the girls read it.
Right.
Because a boy doesn't want to read a book about a little girl doing something.
Right. Unless it becomes a phenomenon, I guess.
Yeah, and I mean, the exception to the rule that I can think of is The Hunger Games, mm-hmm. which stars a girl, but it has crossover appeal if boys and girls read it.
Has violence and stuff.
Yeah. but then it made me think of The Hunger Games episode, which was the first episode we did.
Right.
Where we had a big conversation of, is Katniss too masculine? And right. Do guys like reading the book because Katniss is kind of dude-like? Or what's going on there? So, I mean, there are all sorts of dumb issues that come up with that sort right. of thing.
Well, or the love triangle issue, because
yep.
it's definitely a... It's definitely one of the formulas out there, especially in recent years, is female protagonist who has two hot guys who both like her.
Yeah.
I was like, I'm really tired of that story.
Yeah. Yep.
Can there be zero hot guys who like her? Can, like, guys liking her not be an important part of the story, maybe? I'm just throwing that out there. Especially in, I mean, if I was going to just to... complete this tangent, I guess, but if I was going to complain about one thing about The Hunger Games over everything else, why does there need to be a love triangle in this survival political story?
Yeah, although I will admit that by book 3, that element pretty much drops completely out.
Right.
Because it's more like, I'm totally fucked up from the first 2 books and can't think about a relationship.
Yep.
And then everyone's like, duh, 3rd book sucks. I'm like, Jesus.
Oh, public.
People are missing the fucking... But we'll talk more about The Hunger Games next week.
Oh, can I quote Patton Oswalt about those general public people?
Oh, sure.
Your whole life, nothing will be cool and you'll die angry. Just like the... I might be paraphrasing. But... just the person who doesn't get it.
Yeah.
He took that part out. It sucks now. Oh, you poor bastard.
You just don't know. Yeah. And then a lot of the other things we were kind of thinking about potentially for moral issues also really play into the themes which we've already talked about discussing the characters. So just to bring some of them up again, there's definitely an East versus West thread with the moms from China and the daughters who are born in America and the difference of culture and way of being.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's that even more than the generational thing. Because there's always, I mean, there's always a little bit of conflict between parents and children.
Mm-hmm.
Even if it's just the children trying to kind of break loose from the parents to some degree at certain times in their life. Occasionally, depending on the era you're born into, there'll be major social changes or something where you're likely to support something that is kind of unthinkable to the older generation. Mm-hmm. But in this, it really was more of a American values versus Chinese values, mm-hmm. and the kids looking through life as kind of, oh, I want to do my own thing, and the mothers, even though this wasn't really stated directly, I don't think, it's kind of this mindset of, you have no idea how many opportunities you have, why don't you work hard and take advantage of them, damn it.
Like, I was forced to marry, to go live with this family and become an indentured servant at the age of 15. Right. Like, what the fuck are you doing with your life?
And you can't get along with your husband because the two of you refuse to make choices about anything.
Yeah.
Like, it's not a good enough excuse to mom.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things I really liked was when, so Waverly in her upcoming marriage, they're thinking about taking their honeymoon to China, and she says to her mom, well, what if we go and then they think I'm Chinese and won't let me come back? And her mom's like, oh, they'll know you're not Chinese.
Her mom basically rolls on the floor laughing.
Yeah.
Like, oh, that's absurd.
You really think you can barely even speak Chinese?
She's like four Chinese words.
They are never going to think. And then she's offended. She's like, oh, I'm not Chinese enough.
You learned the Chinese language from watching 10 episodes of Firefly.
Yeah, like, shut up. That was pretty great, though. Obviously, we have the theme of relationships between mothers and daughters, which is basically the only thing we've talked about so far this episode.
It's so obviously the purpose of this book. Yeah. It could almost go unspoken just because it's so obvious.
Yeah. Family connections, drawing into that, like, the way family has to stick together and support each other, even when you hate each other.
Right.
I was particularly struck by this at the end, when Jing Mei and her father go back to China to visit some of his relatives, and then they go to visit her half-sisters. So, like, one of the kind of threads throughout Jing Mei's plot line is she finds out that her mom, one of her mom's school friends actually found her original set of daughters that she had to abandon back during the war. And they're alive and well and, like, write to her and really want to meet her, which I think also shows a difference between Chinese and American, because these daughters are like, oh, you know, like, we always thought of you as our first mother and we're so excited to meet you and all this stuff. And I feel like American kids would find out that they hadn't a mom who abandoned them, you know, for a good reason, however many years ago, and be like, oh, fuck you, I want me, you abandoned me. I don't know if that's a cultural thing, or maybe just these girls are different than, I was thinking I might be one of the moodier, grouchier ones. I'll meet her. And Jing Mei is, like, really worried that she's gonna show up and they're gonna be like, well, we don't care about you and all this stuff. And then she shows up and all three of them are, like, hugging and crying and everything, right. And their dad takes a picture. Her dad takes a picture of the three of them, and she's like, oh, I looked in it and realized, you know, we are fulfilling my mom's final wish sort of thing. And, like, that's, the book ends on that note, so.
Yeah. I would say, even for that matter, the same chapter, same storyline, right before that, when her dad was reconnected with an aunt he hadn't seen in 60 years.
Yeah.
Now they're going, you think a day is enough time to catch up with family, like, you crazy person? And it's like, they're not even close. Like, this, clearly the way that family was defined and valued was different in Chinese culture than in American culture.
Yeah. It seems like the relatives would have to take the two of them and take them back to their village and keep them there for, like, a month.
Oh, yeah, if they could.
Yeah. Instead of just, one day at a hotel in town. I remember in high school once we had a guest speaker in one of my classes. She was Indian and Hindu, and so she was just kind of telling us about, like, her experiences growing up in Johnson County around white people and, like, the differences between her family and, like, typical American culture and stuff. Basically just trying to say, hey, white kids, like, people are different than you. And I remember, I will always remember one of the things she talked about was, like, yeah, you know, if your aunts and uncles and cousins come in from out of town, they'll stay in a hotel and you'll just meet up, like, midday after all of you are ready to go and, like, go do something. And she's like, if I had relatives come in from out of town and they wanted to stay in a hotel, like, my parents would be offended. They would insist they had to stay in our house. Like, they would never even consider not staying in our house. Like, and that was something that I feel like is kind of the same here, where the Chinese family would have totally taken them into their house and just set them up there.
Or the mother staying in the guest room, the small bedroom, and thinking, in a Chinese household, the guest room is the biggest and best room in the house. It'd be the room that they're sleeping in. They would clear out while the guest was there.
Okay, I just totally thought of a Shakespeare reference. I'm just going to share it really fast. So, in his will, he left his wife his second best bed.
And famously, yes.
Yeah, a bunch of modern people were like, oh, deuce. But then, like, according to Elizabethan culture, your best bed was actually kept in your guest room because you wanted to be a good host. And you slept in the second best bed with your wife.
I see.
So he would actually have been leaving her their bed.
Right.
And he wasn't just, like, sucking.
He wasn't taking her over. Because it's true. By modern standards, that does seem like a beyond the grave, fuck you.
To my wife. Yes. Our second best bed. Cock? Yeah. But it's kind of the same thing of, yeah, give your guests the best of everything you have, sort of thing. And then, miscommunication is another big theme I wrote, or inability to communicate at times. It's not so much that they cross wires so much as they can't, just flat out can't understand each other.
It's more like barriers to communication than actual miscommunication.
Yeah. And the moments where they do overcome that are the moments when you see that these pictures or sketches they've drawn of each other aren't just the surface value that you assume.
Right, yeah.
Like, mom's not just a tiger mom, she's...
Well, and how their personalities and who they are is more complex than even their own family sees them.
Mm-hmm.
And, I don't know, maybe that's a... Maybe that's a larger point that's being hinted at as well.
Like, at the beginning when Jing Mei is at the Mahjong game and all of her mom's friends are like, you have to go meet your sisters and tell them all about your mom. And she's like, well, I don't really know anything about her. She's just my mom. And they all got really offended. They're like, you don't know anything about your mother?
Okay, okay, okay. She's my mother. I know stuff.
It's kind of the same deal. We just threw in one symbol for everybody. Jing Mei's mom gives her a jade necklace and tells her it's her life's story or purpose or I don't
spirit
remember
or
the exact word
something.
She uses. Yeah, apparently this jade necklace is a symbol of her life and she needs to wear it around.
Yeah, though
she doesn't really get it.
Say, though depending on who you ask, it could mean a lot of different things.
Yeah.
And she runs into another Chinese person who also has a jade necklace, and he is equally clueless on what his really means.
My mom gave this to me and said it was like my life's.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's like, oh, apparently that's a thing.
But I just think it kind of nicely...
What does it mean? No one knows.
Yeah, nicely ties in that Eastern tradition of, you know, the mom's always saying, like, oh, here's some totally common sense saying that I've grown up saying and believing all my life. And the American kids are like, what the fuck
are you
what
talking,
are you talking
about?
About?
You're a crazy person.
I guess points of interest, I did just want to bring up. We talked a little about all the mother's experiences in China. And it struck me as I was reading that all of their experiences in China take place, you know, 1910s, 20s, up through the 40s. But a lot of their stories focus around, oh, you belong to your husband, or you got remarried after you're widowed, so you're like a prostitute, or whatever's going on. The only way you can escape marriage is death. And reading all of that and being handed over to a husband's family just seems like, isn't that something that should be happening hundreds of years ago and not, well, the book takes place in the 80s, I think, so like not, you know, 50 years ago?
Right.
And so it just draws like another really big distinction between China and the U.S. there.
Yeah,
that really struck me.
I say, for that matter, if you, I mean, it's almost difficult to not accidentally read something about China industrialization and how fast their economy is growing and how they have something like 40 or 50 cities now with a population of a million or more, and just how recently that really came to China.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it just kind of, the historical aspect of the book kind of drives it home and makes me kind of want to know a little more about Chinese history, except I'm pretty sure that even if I try to get the briefest overview I can possibly get while still getting a somewhat complete picture, I'm committing myself to like at least a month of study.
Yeah.
Just to read like one survey history of China. It would have to be,
you just get the most cursory knowledge.
It would have to be 1,000 pages yeah. long. China's history goes back to 4,000-5,000 BC, if not farther.
Yeah.
I mean, no, it's absurd. It's absurd, and it's been, you know, kind of a continuously a country.
Yeah.
For that period. It's not like, oh, the region that became, as opposed to, you know, you could China. Read the history of Italy as far back as we could trace, and it sure as hell hasn't been Italy for most of that
time. No, it hasn't been Italy for very long at all.
It's like maybe 100 years.
Or, I mean, even England and France and Spain, etc., for that matter, didn't right. effectively exist in the Middle Ages.
Right.
But China was China.
Yep.
Mongolia was Mongolia. Japan was Japan. Like,
yeah, well, like when you're reading about ancient Egypt or even pre-Egyptian cultures, you're talking about like Sumeria. Guess what? China was there, guys.
Yeah. Yeah. I feel like that is one of the biggest faults in my learning and my history knowledge is I know so little about that. And it's such a huge part of world history.
I don't know, if you're like in a cross-reference history by like population and length of time that applies to a certain area, that would mean China would have to easily be the largest percentage yeah. of human history, right?
We should see if the community college offers like a survey course or something.
Oh, there you go.
Go take a class.
I'm sure they exist. I'm sure any school with a like with a real in-depth sort of Chinese department of some form.
Mm-hmm.
I would imagine the survey class would have to be like 4 semesters.
I don't know. So you do like American history where you do like the 1700s to 1865.
Oh, yeah.
They do like, okay, BCs, now we're going to go up to
5,000 BC through 3,000 BC.
If you split up Chinese history the same way people split up American history, you'd have to take like
like 30 courses.
You have tons of classes.
I have 90 credit hours in Chinese history. I just finished the survey history. Now I'm going to start specializing.
Now I know some stuff about China.
Yeah, right.
Okay. So strengths and weaknesses of the writing. One of the main strengths, I would say, is how well-developed every character who's focused on in the book is, and that no one's left out as, like, a stereotype or just, you know, this two-dimensional.
I agree. The characters all really felt like real people to mm-hmm. me.
And I don't know how much that's helped by Amy Tan being Chinese American herself. We don't know, you know, if it's autobiographical at all or if she had some of those experiences right. growing up and then went out and did some research or talked to friends or whatever she did. But yeah, it just feels really authentic.
Yeah, it does.
And then Ben had a suggested, you want to say this?
Oh, I just very briefly, because of an offhand reference to a brother's off-screen death, wondered if she went to the dark farm one too many times, which is to say, just put just a, you know, 2% too much tragedy into the book, because most of it seems to be very much in context, and then when mentioning the one older brother who apparently died in a car accident.
Yeah, when he was 16 or something.
We kill off someone's sibling and, like, a neighborhood kid that people knew, and I was just thinking, for this group of people doesn't seem large enough to know quite that many people who died in childhood, like, that young, and I don't know, maybe not, and it's not really that big of a complaint. It was just something that distracting me for maybe 5 minutes.
Ben's just mad she's killing off all the dudes.
Yeah, exactly. I just couldn't get into it. There weren't any male characters.
So, verdict?
I thought it was good. I did like the characters, and it actually was a pretty easy read. It was pretty compelling. I wasn't sure how to make heads or tails of it when I finished. After talking about it, I think that I have a slightly better handle on it, but it's still not something that I really grasp in its entirety. Even though I was kind of joking up at the top of the episode, I kind of would like to talk to a Chinese person about it.
Just walk up to, like, a professor or something and be like, okay, help me out here. Yeah, I really enjoyed it, too. I connected with it more than I... When I finished it, I was more touched by it than I had expected. Not that I really knew anything about it going into it. And I was just particularly fascinated by all these stories from China. Because they just seemed so crazy to have happened within the 20th century to me. I was just completely baffled by that. So, yeah. And again, it's always really refreshing to read a book that's not from the culture or the standpoint that we know really well. And because Asian culture is obviously just a complete, almost unexplored topic for the two of us.
Right.
It just opened up a wealth of stuff. It was just really interesting. So I would recommend you read it. What are you reading, Ryan?
I'm reading the ominously titled Ashes of Victory by David Weber, so, you know, more honor here.
Damn it, Ben.
I'm sorry! I'm obsessing.
I actually haven't started anything new. I finished Allegiant a couple days ago, finished reading this book, and have not yet picked up a new one. I would say Nano is partially to blame for that. I did hit 25,000?
Oh, right.
Or I'm about to hit 25,000. One of the two. I'm right there. So I'm doing much better this year than I did last year.
I almost have caught up to last year. Last year was my own personal record. I had to 23-something for right. craft out. I think I left off at 22 last time I wrote. So one more day, actually. I will probably get there. Yeah. Especially since I'm going to make myself get at least 2,000 out tomorrow, since I probably won't get to write today.
Hell yeah. With that, if you would like to leave any comments, particularly if you have more knowledge than us on the subject of this book, you can drop us a comment at novelideaspodcast.com.
You can email us, novelideaspodcast@gmail.com.
Check us out on Twitter, @novelideaspod.
And we're on iTunes, and if you find us there, rate, review, all that stuff. And actually, I would like to just tag on to that by saying, I know this one was requested by a reader as well as I think most anyway.
Really?
Yeah. Sweet. And so, and actually, I think someone liked or favorited or how it works my tweet.
Yeah, they did.
So, you know, if one of you folks who especially likes this book or feels some deeper connection to it would care to leave even a brief-ish couple sentence comment on why exactly it is you connect so much to it, I would actually really, I'd really love to hear from you.
Yeah, and we might even talk about you on the air. To our vast audience. Yeah, yes.
To our dozens of listeners. So, next week,
yeah, we'll be reading Catching Fire by Suzanne Collins, the second book in the Hunger Games trilogy.
Sorry for jumping the gun a little there.
Yeah, right? We did start talking about it a little bit, but it was kind of related to the topic at hand.
That's right. Which, much like Ender's Game, also has a movie coming up for release here.
Yeah, I think maybe even next weekend.
Yeah.
Not this weekend, but the weekend after that.
I've seen surprisingly little marketing for that movie so far.
Me too.
I'm kind of surprised. But anyway, I think that's going to do it. So,
yep.
We'll see you next time. Bye.